Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Uncle Sam flexes his regulatory muscle. The government proposes some new rules on e-cigs and the internet. And what's changed in the year since that factory disaster in Bangladesh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 24th of April, and it's great to have you with us. I was talking to a lobbyist a few weeks back, and he told me that policymaking in Washington is cyclical. There's legislation, and after that, there's regulation, which is followed by litigation. Well, the lobbyist told me that we're in the regulation stage, which brings us to the news of the day. Efforts to regulate by two different government agencies tell pretty much the same story. The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, proposed a new broadband internet rule. And we'll get to that in a minute. But first, Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us started with the Food and Drug Administration's bid to regulate e-cigarettes for the first time.
E-cigarettes are new, so they're all over the map. Some come from big tobacco firms, some from companies you've never heard of. Some look like regular cigarettes, some look kind of like gadgets from the Starship Enterprise. What they have in common is right now, they're basically unregulated.
At the present time, with FDA having no authority to regulate these products, it is a bit of the wild, wild west.
That's FDA Commissioner Dr. Margaret Hamburg. Her proposal would bar sales to minors and require product approval. But it did not crack down on advertising or flavored products thought to appeal to kids. It's not as tough as industry feared. That has tobacco analysts optimistic and anti-smoking advocates furious.
I think the e-cigarette companies are pretty much given a pass here.
UC San Francisco tobacco control researcher Stanton Glantz wants tougher regulations. The FDA says it needs more research. Kenneth Warner is a University of Michigan public health professor where he studies tobacco use.
We actually have relatively little science on any aspect of e-cigarettes.
He says e-cigarette makers would be smart to accept some regulation and the legitimacy that goes with it. But some will fight with lobbying and bureaucratic weapons.
The industry, if it follows the path of the cigarette industry over the years, will submit huge numbers of comments simply to slow down the process.
It could be years before anything proposed today becomes reality. So at the FDA, going is slow. Over at the FCC, they're talking content we want to go fast. Marketplace's Noel King reports on rules that could determine the fate of our internet.
If the internet were a 5K race, the gun would go off and all the content would start from the same line and finish at the same time, in a tie. The FCC is planning to propose new rules that could let some content sprint during the last mile. Companies like Amazon or Netflix could pay broadband providers, like Verizon or Comcast, to speed to the finish line first. For supporters of net neutrality, or the idea that all net content should travel at the same speed, this is a problem. Astra Taylor is author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age.
It might behoove a company with deep pockets like Amazon or Facebook to pay extra and make sure that they're loaded promptly onto your mobile device. But what about an independent media outlet?
Paul Gallant, a managing director at Guggenheim Securities, says the new proposals could benefit customers.
I think the FCC is starting to realize that maybe having a blanket rule against any kind of traffic prioritization may wall off innovative new business models.
Say Gallant were a Verizon customer.
And ESPN wants to pay Verizon Wireless so that I can watch lots of ESPN video on my Verizon phone for free, that might be a good thing.
The FCC will issue its proposal next month, then it's open for public comment. There may not be a final ruling until the end of the year or later. Paul Gallant says in a year or two for consumers, the internet will probably look a lot like it does today. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little of this and a little of that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One year ago today in Bangladesh, near the country's capital, Dhaka, an 8-story factory building collapsed in a complex called Rana Plaza. 1,129 workers died. It injured more than 2,500. The factory made clothing for companies all over the world, for Walmart, for CNA and Benetton, just to name a few. And after the disaster, there were calls for reform. The BBC's Akbar Hussain covered the collapse and the aftermath, and he joins me now. Hey there, Akbar.
Hello.
Akbar, you're there in Dhaka, and you've spoken with workers and spoken with folks who own these factories as well. And I wonder if things have changed, if you've seen tangible changes to the way these factories are set up, or do they look different?
I mean, to be very honest, I mean, the situation in the physical infrastructure, it has not changed yet. You know, still, workers are alleging that they are working in a very dangerous condition. There are factories in Bangladesh which are very compliant factories. They meet all the standards of international buyers. But there are many factories in Bangladesh which don't comply minimum standards in Bangladesh. And thousands of workers are working there. That's the problem.
This is an incident that attracted so much attention globally. There was this compensation fund that was intended to raise at least $40 million. That hasn't happened. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's a very complex issue. Bangladeshi government owners are saying, yeah, they couldn't ensure the factory's safety and standards just because the international buyers, they always want cheap products from Bangladesh. That's why, I mean, they have to maintain a factory in a cheaper way. And, you know, Bangladesh's garment industry, it's a huge industry for Bangladesh. It earns $20 billion every year. And more than 5 million people are directly employed in the garment industry. And there are other people who have linkage with the garment industry.
This was a factory that did contract work for some big Western companies, Mango and Benetton and others. And I wonder if you've seen those companies traveling more to Bangladesh, if they are taking a closer look at their supply chain since this happened.
You know, Rana Plaza disaster, it was a wake-up call for Bangladesh's garment industry. And not only for the Bangladesh's garment industry, it was a wake-up call for even international buyers and brands also. They're coming to Bangladesh, and I was talking to the trade union leaders, and they were telling me that, yes, the international buyers are now more serious after the Rana Plaza collapse. Yes, they try to maximize their profit, but now they are also focusing on the safety issues. They are actually pressing the garment factory owners to ensure a safer workplace. So things are changing. It has worked, but, you know, the things are going very slow. That's the thing.
The BBC's Akbar Hussain with us on the line from Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. Thank you so much, Akbar.
Thank you.
There'll be an historic vote in Evanston, Illinois. Members of Northwestern University's football team will decide whether the Wildcats will unionize. Tomorrow's decision, along with lawsuits brought by student athletes who think they should be paid, are forcing the NCAA and big football schools to rethink the business model of college sports. Sally Herships has more.
Until recently, schools were only allowed to feed their giant, hulking college athletes a certain amount of food.
There were even rules in place over whether a bagel with cream cheese was a meal or a snack.
Plain bagel, a snack, but a spread makes it a meal. Andrew Moscato is the producer of the documentary Schooled, The Price of College Sports. He says the NCAA's food rule was draconian.
And that was a rule that ultimately was changed, but it was changed because of public pressure and the perception that these athletes are being taken advantage of, considering how much revenue they're bringing back to the universities.
Which is why college football players at Northwestern will be voting on a possible union. Moscato says the students are facing outside pressure from coaches and other members of the community to vote no. Victor Matheson teaches economics at the College of the Holy Cross. He says there's a lot at stake at Northwestern.
Last year, their football team generated just over $30 million in revenue for the school. Out of that, only $5 million went into athletically related student aid for its football players.
But under NCAA rules, amateur student athletes can't be paid. Andy Zimbalist teaches economics at Smith College.
So they are actually looking for a little niche in here which says, yes, we're employees, yes, we can collectively bargain, no, we don't want to get wages, we only want to get better benefits and a seat at the table.
But Zimbalist says what's more important is the momentum for reform. And today, the NCAA said its biggest conferences can now give more aid to their student athletes. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The fashion world has always been notoriously fickle. What's hot this season may be considered passé in just a few months. Thus saith Heidi Klum, one day you're in, the next day you're out. But there's at least one fashion accessory that has had a spectacular run, and that is the Nike Air Jordan. This is the 30th anniversary of the iconic sneaker, which has had a huge impact on the sneaker business. It was the first of many signature athletic shoes, and it spawned a whole generation of underground sneaker collectors that are known as sneakerheads. Collectors that, as Marketplace's David Weinberg reports, aren't so underground anymore.
In the early days, sneakerheads went to online message boards to buy and trade rare shoes.
Most of these people that were looking for these particular shoes, they were located like in the Midwest, down south, in the West Coast.
Joe Guerrero is from Brooklyn. Everyone calls him Sneaker Joe. He was one of the first sneakerheads who figured out how to make money buying and selling rare shoes that weren't available in big retail stores.
So I saw the demand for it, and I met them by hitting up these stores out in downtown Brooklyn, in the Bronx, Harlem, all these mom-and-pop shops that had urban accounts. I just met the demand and started selling on eBay.
Sneaker Joe's business grew. Soon he had international customers. He was cutting deals with stores, buying in bulk. He would sell online till 5 p.m., take a break for a couple hours, then start his second business, hand-delivering rare sneakers to celebrities like Jay-Z and LeBron James.
And that was like, what, up until 2007. Then the market became a little oversaturated, and also became harder to acquire shoes now that all these blogs are reporting and hyping up stuff.
By 2007, sneaker collecting had reached new heights. Camping outside a store for a shoe release was common.
What changed the way sneakers are looked at is information, the internet. If you didn't know that a new Jordan was coming out, you wouldn't be hyped up to get it.
DJ Clark Kent is one of the people Sneaker Joe used to deliver to. He's a record producer and a sneaker aficionado who's designed several shoes for Nike. He says sneaker companies have mastered the art of hype. The limited edition special release is now a standard marketing strategy.
Everybody's hyped for what's coming out on Saturday. Saturday comes, whoever gets it, and then next Saturday there's something else, and then they're hyped all over again.
For Sneaker Joe, camping out overnight for a shoe was not something he was willing to do. Today, there are sneaker conferences and brick-and-mortar stores that have taken the place of entrepreneurs like him, though he does have a new business model. He invented the Sneaker Pimp Tournament, where sneakerheads compete for who has the coolest kicks. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up, cops in California get new partners to combat crime.
I give them a smile, and I'm like, oh, can I get a Swisher Sweet? And then I say, please. And if they give them to me, I say, thank you, and have a nice day.
So polite. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was flat, holding steady at 16,501. The NASDAQ added 21 points, 0.5%, to close at 4148. And the S&P 500 rose 3 points, 0.1%, to end at 1878. Caterpillar scooped up nearly 2% on strong profits. General Motors drove down 0.2%. The Securities and Exchange Commission is looking into GM's delayed recall of more than 2 million cars. 3M ripped off 1%, and Raytheon flew down 4% on disappointing earnings. Facebook unfriended 0.8%. Bond prices were largely unchanged. The yield on the 10-year T-note held firm at 2.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The University of Michigan releases its final April consumer sentiment survey. Pie lovers from around the country convene in Orlando for the National Pie Championships. Imagine having to think about pie for days. And if after eating all that pie you need some exercise, climb a tree. It's National Arbor Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. A story now about data in healthcare. Actually, it's really a story about the lack of data in healthcare. This month, a rigorous, randomized, controlled trial began that'll test a theory a doctor named Jeff Brenner's come up with for treating very sick and very expensive patients. But it's risky. In medicine, a doctor's reputation is everything. So from Marketplace's health desk at WHYY, Dan Gorenstein asks if the gamble by Dr. Brenner, a MacArthur genius, makes him the dumbest guy in medicine, as Dan kicks off a new series we're calling Diagnosis Data.
Driving to a big data conference a few weeks back, Brenner's Mazda compact SUV came to a full stop in the middle of a short highway entrance ramp. He shrugged, a grin playing at the corners of his mouth.
Wait for the car in front of you to go, and then gun it.
I can only watch as we head straight for the 50-mile-an-hour traffic down below, and we actually merge pretty seamlessly.
You have to have a little bit of faith in the universe, though. It's all going to work out.
Here's what you need to know about Dr. Jeffrey Brenner. He really likes to figure out how things work, and he's willing to go to extremes to do it. As a primary care doc in Camden, New Jersey, Brenner's developed a program that addresses one of the most pressing healthcare questions today: how to help the folks who cycle in and out of the healthcare system, the super utilizers.
We can actually take the sickest and most complicated patients, go to their bedside, go with them to their appointments, and help them for about 90 days and dramatically improve outcomes and reduce costs.
Brenner thinks his model works, but it's never been seriously tested. Really, nobody knows what works with this population, at least not for sure. A 2012 British Medical Journal article found over the last 25 years, there's been, wait for it, 6 randomized controlled trials aimed at super utilizers.
All we have are tiny pieces when what's needed is a full arsenal of evidence given the enormity of the challenge.
That's John Barron, president of the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy. Now, to be fair, researchers admit RCTs can be tricky to set up, time-consuming, expensive. Certain situations call for different study designs. But every major health insurance company, Medicare and Medicaid too, has spent billions on superutilizers. In the absence of the most rigorous evidence, how much of this work is built on health policy quicksand?
I can give you an old example of this in medical care.
Duke behavioral scientist Peter Ubel says back in the 80s and 90s, doctors prescribed certain drugs for irregular heartbeats. The medication made those weird rhythms go away, leaving beautiful-looking EKGs.
But no one had tested whether people actually lived longer. And many people thought, why would you do that? We can look at their cardiogram and see that they're getting better. Finally, when somebody put that evidence to the test of a randomized trial, it turned out that these drugs killed people.
Healthcare's littered with these examples, a history Brenner knows well, which is why, when offered a chance to do an RCT of his superutilizer work in Camden, he jumped. Starting this month, Brenner's staff has begun going to city hospitals, like here at Cooper, to recruit the 800 patients needed for the trial. As it gets underway, Brenner's decision raises a question. Why aren't more healthcare luminaries putting their brilliance to the test? A couple of reasons. One, Brenner says when you've got a brand like his, he's on magazine covers, works the speaking circuit, gets grants, you don't have to.
There's a long-standing trend in healthcare to use clout and professional status. It's really easy for me at this point, having gotten a MacArthur Award, to simply declare that what we do works and to drive this work forward.
Simply, Brenner says in medicine, it can pay to be opaque. But Duke's Peter Ubel says it's too easy and, frankly, wrong to say the main reason doctors avoid these rigorous studies is because they're afraid to lose money and status. He says it's because even docs, who sometimes see themselves as scientists, can fall into the very human trap, being sure their own ideas are right.
Everything you see is filtered through your hopes, your expectations, and your pre-existing beliefs. And that's why I might look at a grilled cheese sandwich and see a grilled cheese sandwich, and you might see an image of Jesus.
Even with all these hurdles, MIT economist Amy Finkelstein, who's running the RCT with Brenner, sees changes coming.
Providers have a lot more incentive now than they used to. They have much more skin in the game.
She says hospital readmission penalties and new ways to pay doctors bring market incentives that have long been missing. Back on the road, Brenner understands the truth of what he's doing in Camden may be messier than the myth. But he says he can live with that.
I think a lot of people are afraid to be wrong, it's kind of fun to be wrong, because being wrong frees you up from things that are not true and lets you move on to figuring out what's true.
If his brand does take a hit, it means more time at work, more time to figure out what works. And Brenner says he's willing to go wherever that takes him. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Our diagnosis data stories are produced in collaboration with APM's Healthy States. You can find them online at healthystates.org. It's almost May, and for many teenagers, that means it's time to look for summer jobs. In California, some high schoolers have landed work that'll give them money to buy booze and cigarettes. All right, it's not what you think. These teens have been hired to help curb underage drinking and smoking. Police have recruited them. Here's how it works. They go undercover to buy beer or a pack of cigarettes. Maybe they ask a stranger for help. And if they succeed, police officers will arrest everyone who helped them out. All students need to participate is a little training, their parents' consent, and a lot of nerve. On a recent Saturday, 100 of these young decoys netted 544 arrests across California. Youth Radio's Edna Miller did a ride-along in the Bay Area, and she brings us this story.
I'm in an unmarked car, charging towards a startled man in a black Chevy.
He's trying to drive up. Oh, my God.
The sergeant jumps out of the driver's seat and runs towards the suspect on foot. While out of sight, officers in bulletproof vests swarm in, cutting off the man's escape routes.
Oh, snap.
His crime? Buying a six-pack of Coors Light for an undercover teen.
I'm Daniel. I'm the decoy. I'm the guy that messes up people's days, I guess.
That's Daniel Gardner, an 18-year-old youth decoy. Plain clothes and not wearing a bulletproof vest. He's undercover with the Alameda County Sheriff's. The officers just arrested a middle-aged man in a sweatsuit. The violator, a guy named Fred, is the fourth person busted for buying alcohol for a minor at this location in the past hour and a half. Fred has his reasons.
Hey, I was so
tell you why I did it.
Listen. Right.
You're the same height as my son, and you look kind of like him. You white, though, but you look kind of like him, same build. You feel me?
Even though Fred is facing a possible $1,000 fine and 24 hours of community service, he praises the youth decoy who set him up.
Hey, thank you, young man. You're a good actor, dude.
What did he just say? What did he say?
He called me a good actor.
Let's meet another cast member of this youth production. Lisette Araujo is 16, but is no stranger to the game.
They call me the veteran.
This is Araujo's third year as a youth decoy, where she works on tobacco stings, going into corner stores and buying flavored cigars called Swishers.
I usually walk inside the stores. I give them a smile, and I'm like, oh, can I get a Swisher Sweet? And then I say, please. And if they give them to me, I say, thank you, and have a nice day. And I smile.
That's cold-blooded. Evidently, sometimes being a youth decoy means putting duty before empathy.
This lady, she didn't speak any English.
Wow.
I was talking to her in Spanish. And then when she got the citation, she was like, can you please tell him that they're going to kick me out of my job because wow. I did this. I'm like, I'm sorry, but next time you should be more careful. And she's like, please help me. And she got so mad that she started crying.
All that drama and a $200 to $1,000 fine may seem like a severe penalty for selling tobacco to a minor. Back at the alcohol decoy operation, Sergeant Schuler says these things sometimes catch people engaged in worse crimes.
A lot of times what we find is the people that are willing to buy alcohol for a minor, a lot of times they've been involved in other criminal activity.
According to the statewide agency that sponsored these operations, about 10% of people cuffed today actually went to jail on crimes ranging from drunk driving, illegal drug possession, to resisting arrest. Apart from sending people to jail, Sergeant yep. Schuler says the youth decoy program also brings some kids into the force.
So maybe you might want to think about pursuing a career in law enforcement. You could do this as your job and get paid.
All right, so you're trying to persuade me.
The best job in the world, if you ask me.
Okay. Decoys like Daniel, who we heard being committed for his acting ability earlier, don't need persuading. Daniel intends to be a sheriff. He knows some kids have gone from the decoy program straight into the police academy. For me, trapping somebody who thinks they're doing me a favor is too much. It makes me feel callous and dishonest. But as Fred, the guy who bought the six-pack, can tell you, a citation does get the message across.
So everybody makes mistakes in life. This was mine. You don't have to worry about me ever doing this again.
Me either. In Hayward, California, I'm Edna Miller for Marketplace.
And Edna's story was produced by Youth Radio.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we mark the passing of yet another periodical, Ladies' Home Journal, will no longer be published monthly. The first issue was printed in 1883, and back then it was called the Ladies' Home Journal and Practical Housekeeper. Its slogan, "Never underestimate the power of a woman." Well, today the Meredith Corporation, which owns Ladies' Home Journal, released its quarterly earnings, and the earnings call was as good an opportunity as any, I guess, for the company to fire everyone on the magazine's editorial staff. A company spokesman said, "It's not a consumer issue, it's an advertising issue." And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm David Gura. Kai Rizdal is back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.